Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. On the show today, we're going to be marvelling misty-eyed at the lost world of advertising for alcohol and tobacco. In the advertising industry, behind closed doors, it was known as the sin sector. These ads for booze and fags paid for a lot of second homes, jags and expensive divorces for the key creatives of Madison Avenue and Charlotte Street. The Marlboro Man, that iconic camel and silk-cut surrealist take on no longer being able to show the product in the advertisement, met iconic ads for Absolut Vodka, Johnny Walker and Beck's Beer. The zenith of the four martini lunch and the pack of Chesterfields a day made a golden age of advertising in which kings of creative enjoyed big budgets and then, latterly, were inspired by the constraints of the Surgeon General. And why now? Well, the preeminent art and design publisher Taschen is due to print its definitive 20th century alcohol and tobacco advertising book this spring, and it is that and the beautiful, wise, witty, wonderful and deadly stuff inside that we celebrate today. What is it about badness that brings out the good? Find out as we talk creativity, whiskey and baccy on The Culture Show. So we'll start at the source. Taschen's upcoming book, 20th Century Alcohol and Tobacco Advertising, is a fairly exhaustive and typically sumptuous look at the creative, the print ads mostly, that suggested the romantic, the idyllic, the call of the wild and the lure of the great outdoors, the sophisticated and urbane, the funny, the artistic, all within those 100 years when smoking went from being as normal as breathing to becoming something recommended for its healthy and relaxing qualities to something that became a banner of female emancipation to something altogether different. For booze, most ads depicted civility and prosperity, good taste. The editor of the Taschen book, Jim Hyman, joins us on the line from Los Angeles to talk through the making of the book and what it means.
Line up for Richmond!
On stage and screen and radio, Ann Southern is a star. She's chosen camels 'cause she knows how mild camels are.
Camels, smoke camels, and see how mild.
Try camels yourself. Make the one sensible cigarette test. Make your own 30-day camel mildness test in your T-zone and see how well camels agree with your throat. Pack after pack, week after week. See for yourself why camels are so popular with the doctors of America.
The bulk of the ads are for my personal collection. I've been collecting magazines for the past 40 years for various projects of my own and also, you know, certainly for Taschen. So that's where they come from. So I hit the swap meet flea market every Sunday. And that's where the stuff, you know, initially comes from.
And to get into kind of the meat and potatoes of some of the work, Jim, here, I mean, it's such beautiful stuff. And of course, a lot of people reading this book, imagery will flash before them. The Marlboro Man, you know, some in England, some of those Benson and Hedges, the sort of surrealist Benson and Hedges campaigns of the 1980s when you weren't actually really allowed to show the product in the shots. In terms of the print advertising, we go right back to sort of the Edwardian era, the frontiersmen and women of America, and also sort of female liberation and smoking as a sign of your emancipation as a woman. There are all sorts of things that play into this. You've taken it in a chronological order, but going from images of ancient Egypt at the turn of the century to kind of surrealist cigarette packaging in the UK, when you got the wealth of stuff together, were you surprised at the breadth of the creativity and the imagery that you saw and the different messages given out by the brands about their products?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I think one of the big surprises for me was to find, you know, the graphics, especially from the first part of the 20th century leading up until the 1930s. But that 30-year period produced, you know, some really beautiful graphic images to support, you know, the sale of alcohol and tobacco. So that was kind of a nice revelation. And then, of course, as you mentioned, you know, as we go through each one of these decades, there's highlights within each one of those decades. I think another aspect that I was, you know, really looking for was the validation by the medical establishment that smoking was okay. So that you have doctors having testimonies and pictures of nurses smoking cigarettes and saying, oh, it's so smooth on your throat. So that kind of propaganda that was certainly later in the early 60s was shot down by the medical establishment. It's interesting to see how these tobacco companies were misleading the American public by showing or telling them that, don't worry about it, you know, it's good for you, it's healthy, it's, you know, it's mild, it's not going to affect your health. So that was another aspect that I was looking for. And there's a couple instances in the 1950s where they have a photograph of a young baby around, you know, old enough to talk, you know, 2 or 3 years old, saying, "Before you get angry at me, Mom, please, you know, light up a cigarette so you can calm down."
Gee, we ought to do something, Fred.
Okay.
How's about taking a nap? Hey, I got a better idea. Let's take a Winston break.
That's it. Winston is the one filter cigarette that delivers flavor 20 times a pack.
You get the feeling, Jim, reading through your book, that there's a crisis point at which, as you say, that the intelligent people of the world or the West sort of suddenly go, hang on, this is not good for you. And they have to sort of do this convincing thing. But then once everyone kind of knows that it's probably bad for your health to smoke, the kind of sin aspect of it, or the kind of the masculine and sort of frontiersman aspect of it, comes to the fore, doesn't it? It's like, well, it might be bad for you, but it makes me a man. Or there's a different sort of outdoorsy advertising that perhaps comes out of that knowledge about the lack of the health benefits. Benefits of smoking.
Oh, exactly. They just, you know, the companies just shifted gears and refocused, you know, what they were selling. So the Marlboro Man, followed by, you know, imitations of that icon, definitely were the focus of it. You know, and then when, as it became more problematic to even show cigarettes, you know, Marlboro didn't even bother showing a cigarette. You know, you ended up by the 21st century, you just have four horses and with the world Marlboro, and that's how they're selling cigarettes. So yeah, that, and also coming up with all these different icons, not only within the tobacco industry, within the liquor industry, Spuds McKenzie, you know, that little bulldog, and also the camel cigarette icon, that cartoon camel that eventually was banned because the powers that be saw that as trying to sell to a younger age, you know, selling cartoon characters smoking as a way to introduce young, you know, a younger generation into the smoking thing. So yeah, they knew their time was up in terms of, you know, trying to sell the health aspects of it. So then they just shifted gears and went to different kinds of imageries, you know, and lifestyle to seduce people to use the product.
I mean, there seems to be something, reading through the book, and I was trying to think, how is this advertising imagery, how is the messaging and the artwork different from trying to sell a soft drink? Or, you know, when we're talking about alcohol, for example, how is it different to selling Dr. Pepper or Coca-Cola or Sprite or even a fast-moving consumer good like a cleaning product or washing up liquid or something like that? There is something that is very specifically a spinning of a myth, a spinning of a yarn about the foundation of manhood or the foundation of America or indeed the United Kingdom. There is something that very elemental and mythical and story-based that uses a lot of assumptions about what we think of ourselves that is very different to selling fairy liquid or a bar of soap or a can of Dr. Pepper, right?
Yeah, I think so. Although both of them lean heavily on lifestyle, so that, you know, with Coca-Cola and some of these other soft drink companies, they'll always kind of portray, you know, the act of, you know, drinking their beverage, as well as the alcohol advertisers were also leaning heavily on, you know, lifestyle. That if you took part of their product, then you were entering, you know, a different place, some place that could be hip. It could also be, you know, a little bit more elegant. But the lifestyle aspect of it runs through a lot of these things that were common denominator. But clearly, when you get into alcohol and tobacco, yeah, there's a lot of ways that they're trying to sell you that product that doesn't really translate into other products.
There's a sort of idea of late night sophistication, of sexiness, of allure, of good taste. It's a more of a dark hued, subtle world, isn't it? The world of alcohol and tobacco advertising.
Definitely. There certainly is that aspect. I mean, there's some ads with Hugh Hefner and so on. And the use of celebrities is also, I think, an aspect that was a big part of selling the cigarettes, which is not uncommon to a lot of advertising, but certainly with alcohol and tobacco, they leaned heavily on movie stars primarily, you know, to show that this kind of was an adult world and very glamorous, and that you could partake in that world if you smoked a cigarette or drank this particular brand of alcohol. There's a lot of aspects of the advertising that they're heavily leaning on to get you to go for their product.
I read a book before Christmas by Stephen Bailey, who's going to appear on this show, in fact, after you, Jim. And he said that a lot of advertising, especially of alcohol and tobacco in the 20th century, was akin to folk art. It's how we judge ourselves in the late 20th and early 21st century. Brands mean something, and we associate ourselves and sort of pit ourselves against them. They are part of the world that we've constructed around ourselves. After putting this beautiful, large kind of book together, where do you stand on that, as this sort of advertising, particularly as a sort of folk art?
There's a period piece to the whole thing. I think what it really shows us is, like you mentioned, I mean, this is kind of the world that we were a part of and creative, and all these cultural timeline points are all kind of touched through the product advertising. So I don't know if you're, you know, if you're going to see as much as that. There certainly is, you know, as the print world succumbs to the digital world, the lasting appeal of these things is going to be very transient, I think, nowadays. And so there are definitely some great pieces of artwork that were there. And I think that's something that you're not going to, you know, have in the future. I think another aspect of this book and looking at advertising, you know, it's kind of the attention that gender played in selling products. And certainly women were always included in selling these products because they were a market that was large and untapped. And so that was something that advertisers certainly were looking for, you know, whether it was an automobile or a cigarette or alcohol. And then when you got into the, you know, the 60s and you had cigarettes specifically designed exclusively for women. So, you know, again, these are the kind of things that you kind of look at and tap into. And yeah, it does have that kind of folk art aspect to it.
The good old days. When Mrs. Pamela Benjamin was caught smoking in the garden, she got a severe scolding and no supper that night. Later, Mrs. Cynthia Robinson was caught smoking in the cellar behind the preserves. Although she was 34, her husband sent her straight to her room. Then, at last, women won their rights.
You've come a long way, baby.
Introducing new Virginia Slims, the Slim cigarette.
And also interestingly on the gender thing, as is so often the case, this line of inquiry hasn't finished yet, but in order to sell cigarettes to women, you show pictures of women enjoying themselves and looking carefree and sophisticated. In order to sell cigarettes to men, you show pictures of women not perhaps looking so sophisticated but sexy. I mean, it's the sort of ideas of politics and gender are also written through this book, aren't they? Accidentally in the advertising imagery.
Oh, definitely. And you see it, you know, not only gender, but also depictions of race, because you don't see African-Americans depicted whatsoever or any other minority depicted until the mid-1960s. And then you start to see, certainly in the 1970s, African-Americans being integrated into this advertising, less so Hispanics and Asians. But that, again, kind of reflects society at large and certainly American society. And how do you appeal to people's sensibilities? You do it through the most common denominator, which had, for the bulk of the 20th century, has always been seen through the eyes of white male, basically. So there's a lot of things that are, you know, kind of interesting. We're working on a project right now for all-American ads of the 90s and all-American ads of 2000 to 2010. And it's amazing how hypersexualized advertising became in the last, you know, 20 or 30 years. And it's just amazing. I mean, we're working on alcohol, the section right now from 2000 to 2010. And it's so hard not to have something that's really, really, really sexual selling alcohol. I'm really having a tough time to find things that are a little less neutral.
Come a long way, baby, to get where you got to today.
Now, to put the book and that golden age of advertising into context, who else would we turn to but Stephen Bailey, a critic, commentator, and while we're here, co-founder of London's Original Design Museum, an appreciator of the finer things in life, sure, but also someone who might be able to tell us why. Bailey's most recent book looks at brands, what they mean, why they stick, if they're successful, and why they matter. Stephen Bailey says that brands and advertising are our new folk art. Fighting talk? Not on your Nelly.
Light up a lucky.
It's light up time.
Be happy, go lucky.
It's light up time.
For the taste that you like, light up a lucky strike.
Relax.
It's light up time.
In the advertising trade, I mean, alcohol and drink is known as the sin sector. I mean, I'm a bit of a specialist in sin. Yeah, there's an extraordinary, interesting history here, as this glorious book reveals. There's no doubt in my mind that the great ads and the great cigarette ads and the great, you know, the great drink ads are some of the best of their sort ever, which is, you know, these are actually our culture. They really are. They are our folk art. And what interests me and why I wrote my little polemical book about branding and advertising is that this current legislation, which is stigmatizing the sin sector, and this valuable culture, this culture of dreams, of yearnings, of ideals, you know, ideal conditions, it's what the critics have called it, you know, objectifying pleasure. It's completely under threat. And they've already started, I mean, cigarettes are now, please don't misunderstand, I'm no cheerleader for the tobacco interest. I personally detest smoking. I wouldn't mind if it was made illegal, but it's not illegal. You have this extraordinary position when a product which is not yet illegal, let's say, cigarettes, you have government interference with the way they're sold and package. And as a non-smoker, I actually don't want to go into me and my newsagent and find
a wall of
and find
brown
a
paper.
Wall of terrible 60. It's by law 60% of cigarette packaging has to show gruesome medical photographs of tobacco-related disorders. And I'm all for absolutely optimum health education. You know, that's fine, but I don't want to be assaulted by this. I don't want to be assaulted by that. But also, I deeply regret the loss of that whole culture. And if the puritanical authorities can do it with cigarette advertising and branding, they'll do it soon with drink branding. And in fact, it's already happened. There was an experiment recently in the Yukon, of all things, when they were in Canada, a tiny province of Canada, where they
small but the hardest drinking, possibly.
Because they have weather to, you know, they have weather which excites that sort of lust, and they had legislation there which required, I can't remember, 60% of the bottle. Da, da, da. You know, and I think they've actually now withdrawn it. There have been so many complaints about it, but that's just the beginning. It's the slippery slope. It's the thin end of the wedge.
And we lose a lot by banning things. We lose a lot of beauty, as you say. You make an interesting point in your book. There is folk art. This book is not out yet in a form that we can properly look at it, but I've printed off some pages, and some of it is undoubtedly folk art or fairly high art. I mean, there, as we said, there are sort of romantic touches to this. There are things that touch on the art of empire, on the art of westward expanding white man in the American West. There are all these sorts of things. I mean, this is welcome to Marlborough country.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. You know, as I said, I'm not advocating smoking, but Marlborough is a very interesting topic in this context. I mean, Marlborough was originally smoked by women. It was a product designed for women, and they designed. And indeed, cigarettes. Let's understand this. I mean, goodness me, you can't say this sort of thing nowadays. But cigarettes were advertised to women as in the 20s and 30s as torches of freedom. It was one of the great ad campaigns of all time. Women could demonstrate their liberation from social constraints by lighting up. It's of course it's risible, but it was actually represented a genuine movement. And Marlborough then decided that sometime in the 1950s they decided they didn't want to do it to women, and then they created what's possibly the most famous man in the world, the Marlborough, Marlborough Cowboy. Boy.
The essence of the rugged.
Yes, well, they actually considered doing construction site workers and lumberjacks and typical market research. And they just determined in the end they would do a cowboy, suntanned, with his leather, whatever, his chaps and his rugged look and his blue eyes and his gritty, flinty. Yeah, the great American contemporary novelist, writer, the guy who wrote that George Clooney movie, somebody called Walter Kern, wrote that one of the most mystical, magical things you can do is to enjoy a famous American product in a famous American landscape. And if you ever go into it, a Marlboro cigarette is forever going to be associated with the Grand Canyon. Now, people involved in advertising and the larger issues coming out of advertising, like the whole world, the metaphysics of the brand. What is a brand? It's a promise. All brands are, whether you're talking about soap, cigarettes, alcohol, cars. You're promising something to your consumer. You're promising you can enter a dream world. You can end this. And once you decide you're going to offer your consumer entry into a dream world, you have to get going on the art.
Then the art is going to be pretty key.
Absolutely.
Coors, America's fine light beer, recalls this joy of living with its sparkling, natural taste. Brewed with pure Rocky Mountain spring water, it embodies all the goodness of the high country. The light golden color of Coors.
One of the interesting things, you touched on it in your book, it's displayed beautifully in the pages of this new Taschen book on 20th century tobacco and alcohol advertising, Stephen, is the benefit of constraint and how that can set a proper creative free. And I know whether it was in the late 70s or early 80s, you stopped being able to have your product in the pack shot. And certainly no people being able to enjoy the product, whether it's a cigarette. Latterly, it's been alcohol on television advertising here in the UK, at least. And so you started getting this quite surrealist movement. Silk Cut and Benson and Hedges, some of the British
brands.
You
certainly did, but this is a fundamental artistic principle. Yeah. Sir Joshua Reynolds, the founder of London's Royal Academy, said in 1756, he said, rules are an inspiration to genius, not an impediment to it. Mm. And that remains true today. They say in the ad world, please give me the liberation of a tight brief. You know, the more tricky the brief is, the more demanding it is, the more freedom. I mean, there's nothing so ruinous for
go off and write a novel.
Do what you like. You know, make it up yourself. Yeah. The tighter the brief, exactly. And as soon as some of the most extraordinary cigarette ads were created in the 70s and 80s, when by the Collett, Dickinson, Pearson agency, the iguana was the most famous one, which actually shows. It's mostly about an iguana. I mean, I think the cigarette pack actually appears at some, but it's very much secondary to the reptile. And the fact the product wasn't shown seems to have had no effect whatsoever on the appeal of the brand. It's very difficult. You can't legislate against. Well, you can, but only in a totalitarian regimes would want to legislate against individuals' taste, which is frankly what we're
These are the brown paper cigarette packets, yeah, aren't they? This is the sort of start.
Why should I be stigmatized if I want to smoke? Why can't I have the fun of being a Marlboro man or a rugged, senior service, Jolly Jack tar? It's a dream world. Our entire culture is one of dreams and projections and desires. I mean, desire being that wishing about something to happen in the future. And this is what advertising and branding is about, creating dream worlds.
We've talked a lot about cigarettes. There's obviously the other side of the sin sector. Before we move on to booze, calling it the sin sector is a bit of a, you're on a hiding to nothing before you begin there, because we're kind of, you've got built-in decadence, yes, to use the word slightly wrongly,
yes,
there. Is that part of the problem, that if we think it's naughty, then we're trying to sort of convince people to sort of offload some of their cares and escape to a world of martinis and the Marlboro
Man? Well, I think we all want to, while I wouldn't advocate sin, but I think
Stephen Bailey with his lying face. There.
We like a little bit of decadence. Well, actually, the sins are all rather. Well, Tom Wolfe once said the only one of the seven deadly sins which is not enjoyable is envy.
Yeah.
Six of the seven deadly sins: lethargy, lust, greed. They're hugely enjoyable. What is it about the Puritan mentality? I mean, in my own little books, Signs of Life, I make the point that there were attempts in the Renaissance to impose sumptuary laws on people. On the way people dressed. You weren't allowed, if you're a woman, you weren't allowed to have much cleavage. If you're a man, you weren't allowed to have too much silk or too much jewellery. And, they all failed. I mean, this legislation against taste can only be effective in North Korea or any other totalitarian regime. And we are, we're free spirits, and we should be able to enjoy and engage in the dream world, the seductive dream world. So, manufacturers of all products want to create. Now, by any means, I make myself sound like some sort of mute, stupefied, gormless consumer. I'm all for being absolutely radical criticism of manufacturers, but that's the whole point. You can criticise. You don't have to. We're looking here at some sheets of Chesterfield cigarettes.
Yeah, there's some proper old gear on here.
You don't have to buy these things, but if you are going to buy them, why not engage in the promises involved?
Why is Budweiser the largest selling beer in the world?
Why is Budweiser the largest selling beer in the world? Oh, why is it the largest selling beer in the world?
And before we go, Stephen, I wondered if we can bore down into the heart and soul of some of the reasons why booze and fags were advertised in the way that they were, to decide something about the product itself, whether there is something in the sin sector, or whether there's something in that idea of decadence, whether something which will give you a frisson of death is always imbued with romance. And it's always sold as romantic, whatever it is.
One doesn't want to talk of being extremely bad taste to be facetious about fatal diseases caused by consumption of sugar, for instance. But, historically in the cigarette business, it's only relatively recently that they've been known to have devastating effects on health. It's only in the last 50 years or so. If you look, you can see cigarette ads from the 30s and 40s where they're still saying that cigarettes are actually good for your health.
Yeah.
They're good for your throat and they're good for... that's total bollocks. Of course it is. But that's only relatively recently. But the point is that all things taken in excess and handled badly. And butter is an exceptionally lethal product if used... it is. If used to excess. That's the danger here. I mean, alcohol clearly is that no one wants to condone, alcohol fueled licentious or grotesque behavior. Of course not, but the whole world of values involved in, just look at the wine. I mean, it's not even just the advertising, just look at that glorious culture of wine labels. I mean, a great myth for me, being a bit of a sort of graphics lovey, substantial part of the pleasure of wine comes from the graphic design of, you know, of the labels. And I think a lot of people enjoy that. I mean, what a glorious thing it is to go into a wonderful wine merchant and just... It's like a library. It's a gallery. Well, it really is.
Yeah.
And the discipline, just the artistic discipline involved in a tiny wine label. You've got to say something about, you know, what the grape is, where it comes from, or to give a suggestion of its cost. And that's a fantastic discipline. It's glorious. And, you know, and if we let the top-thumping, thin-lipped Puritans get away with it, that's all going to disappear.
What beer is good for the choicest hops, rice, and best barley malt? Budweiser! In other words, taste it!
Thanks to Stephen Bailey for joining us on the programme. So what legacy do these adverts leave? We'll give the final word to Jim Hyman, who tells us how 20th century advertising provides a vivid art and social history.
I think that there's a whole nother level of how people are being sold products these days. And certainly the digital world has changed a lot of that. But yeah, that golden age of advertising that you're speaking of is definitely showcased here, as well as the golden age of illustration. Because you'll see as the 20th century moves along, by the mid-1960s, illustration starts to fade away and photography takes over, you know, over everything. So illustration becomes kind of a minor part. But that golden age of illustration is fully represented in both the alcohol and tobacco ads. And that's another aspect that I think is definitely something that was appealing to me. These are the things that made that part of the 20th century so supreme in a lot of ways.
I guess its advertising is the thing that cuts through everything else. It is supposed to be beautiful, but at the end of the day, it is supposed to twist your arm, right? So we are seeing, but as you say, we're either cutting down through the middle of the human experience or we are pandering to the lowest common denominator, but it never stops being fascinating.
Yeah, it's this ever-evolving story that just is not only a story of advertising, it's kind of a story of, you know, who we are. And it's fascinating to, you know, look at, you know, through that particular prism of advertising and see what the Western world is all about. And advertising certainly is a magnifier of all that.
For the taste that you like, light up a Lucky Strike, relax, it's light up time.
Jim Hyman is the editor of 20th Century Alcohol and Tobacco, 100 Years of Stimulating Ads, which comes out on February 20th, published by Taschen. Stephen Bailey's book, Signs of Life, Why Brands Matter, is out now, published by Circa. That brings us to the end of this week's show. Don't forget, you can listen back to all of our episodes at monocle.com, and you can pick up a copy of Monocle magazine from all good newsstands. In the latest edition, we go on set at some of America's favourite TV game shows, and we take a trip to one of Tokyo's best animation studios. Join us again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bounds, and thank you very much for tuning in.